Chuck, I asked about your query around reallocation and unspent funds, and that should be appearing at next month's meeting.
Okay.
Thank you for putting that in my head and reminding me. Appreciate it.
Okay. No, it's just we do the same thing every year, so it's like, yeah.
You have a mind like a steel trap, Chuck.
I wish.
Hey, Jenna.
Hello, hi everyone. Nice to see you all.
Me see if we are at quorum. I think we should probably just give it another minute or two. Open that document. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11 people. Unfortunately, without Valerie here, not only am I the minutes taker, so speak slowly. I don't know who has emailed to be excused. That's terrible. Okay, so I'm going to just do a little manual count off here and see if we have quorum. I'm going to mute myself so you don't hear me count out loud. How embarrassing. We'll need five people for quorum, and we have one, two, three, four. We have six. We have established quorum. So Chuck, you can start whenever you would like to start.
Let's do introductions. I'm Chuck Adams, one of the co-chairs for the committee. Go ahead, David.
Hi, so it's David Gonzalez. I am the other co-chair for the committee.
Jackson.
Hi, I'm Jackson Bowman. I use he and him pronouns. I'm a council member.
And Matt?
Matt Geltmaker, council member.
And Jesse?
Yeah, Jesse, she, her, also just a council member.
And Irma?
Irma Barada, council member as well.
And Jenna?
Hey everyone, good afternoon. My name is Jenna Rupwest. You, she, her pronouns. I'm not a council member, I've been a program director of Gender Health SF.
Okay, great. And then next is.
Karen should be joining us a little bit.
Okay. And so next is the agenda, right? Do you have that? Any changes or moving around that anybody wants to do?
You'll see here, we only have one agenda item. So yep. Might be a shorter meeting. It is a long presentation, but neither Jenna or Aaron will be going over slide by slide. So there you have it.
Yeah, we'll approve that by consensus. And now the minutes.
One moment.
I'll give you a minute to look through that. If there's no changes, then we'll approve that by consensus. And then is announcements, correct? Yeah, any announcements from anybody? Nope.
Well, the only announcement is that we are still in a holding pattern when it comes to any kind of return to in-person meeting. That certainly will not be happening before the fall, say that at least.
Okay, thanks for that.
Oh, and there's one more announcement. We've decided to move the steering meeting for this Thursday to next week Thursday.
I'm so glad.
Yeah, so just, I forgot that we should start making that announcement now. So yeah, So the steering meeting will be now from this week Thursday to next week Thursday, same time. So we can have a presentation from Sid and Spano at HCAP. So yeah, just want to make that announcement.
Okay, that works. And then what was next on the agenda?
Well, we have a couple things before Jenna jumps in. It looks like Jack has a general question, and I'll provide some framing before Jenna reviews what she'll be going over. So maybe Jack should go first with a question.
Go ahead, Jack.
Maybe this is a question for steering, but this is my committee, so I thought I'd bring it up here. Are we considering the possibility of either continuing to have remote council meetings and or remote committee meetings?
That's what the discussion is all about.
I'd say that everything is on the table as far as what we're talking about, including such ideas as in-person full council and remote subcommittees, not including steering, perhaps blended meetings, although that can be a challenge, of course, blended meeting virtual and in-person. So Jack, everything's on the table, but right now the table's not even set because we really want to make sure. That was a terrible, terrible analogy. It sounded clever when I said it though. We just are waiting for more guidance.
Yeah, I think to be really clear, what's really, really going to dictate how we move forward is going to be Sunshine and Brown Act. So that's a thing. It's like if we can be like, we want to go online. Well, if Sunshine Brown says, no, y'all, you need to be in person, then that would be the deciding factor. The other idea is just to be really brief about this. Not brief, but just have more information is that, you know, I think this committee is the one that's like, oh, we can do this online. Why not? The other committees have had members who just want to actually meet. So the idea has been, hey, you know what? We can really do the steering couldn't be the committee that meets in person because we can all make recommendations online. And so we can sort of, you know, bypass the Brown and Sunshine Act. But then whatever we recommend, we go to steering to them for them to either vote on, to agree upon, or send it back to committee. So that's also one of the possibilities and options. Really, it's about seeing what, you know, again, what the guidance is, but it's gauging sort of what we're allowed to do and not to do. And so the conversation is not ending. Just an FYI, we were having a conversation yesterday with co-chairs, and we realized, you know what, we might be where, like, this year the summit may have to be online because the summit's supposed to be 2 months from now. We haven't heard anything yet. And so we might have to split that up into two meetings, wait and see. But if we haven't gotten any guidance by next month, I personally don't want to, you know, start doing things last minute, you know, planning things for this big meeting if there's no clear indication of how we're supposed to conduct it. So for me on my end, I'm like, let's just continue doing the things that we're doing online and then really, really vet that question further down the year.
Plus, some of it depends on what COVID does with the new strain. So, okay, Mark.
Sure. So, about 2 years ago, this committee said that it has been a long time since we've had presentations or updates about the many trans communities that are a big part of who we serve as a council. In fact, the last time we had something major was actually our needs assessment that we did in collaboration with the Transgender Center of Excellence. So that was a while ago. And so unfortunately, pandemic happened and things got in the way of us being able to have this presentation. But at long last, we are getting it this month. I'm so excited that Jenna and Aaron agreed to speak to the council. In fact, we're pretty much giving this presentation as much time as it needs. So it'll be the only presentation on the agenda for this month. And my understanding, and this might have changed since I've last spoke with Jenna and Aaron, is that it will be in three parts, a piece on trans humility, a piece on data that has been collected around the challenges and needs and experiences of the trans communities around HIV, and then The third part being something that moves beyond HIV prevention and care and is looking at all the other cofactors to health and living that are a part of the trans community's lives. So with that as the preamble, either Jenna or Aaron, feel free to go.
Hi, Erin. Are you okay if I take a stab first?
Please.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for just inviting us. It's a pleasure to see many familiar faces and also new faces in this space. Jenna Rapp-West here, a Program Director of Gender Health SF. And I'm also just very, just for context, how I got into public health is actually HIV prevention, and I did a lot of work around community planning. And part of that just, it was related to just a lot of things that was happening like late in the 90s, early 2000s in HIV prevention, which is a narrative around exclusion of trans folks and HIV data and prevention efforts with, you know, just a lot of the challenges around data collection and representation and whatnot and research. And so I think that that is, this is really important to kind of hold that frame, at least from how what I'm gonna like share with you all and what I'm thinking about what might be helpful for an update for the council. And so I think one of the things that Mark has approached us is just really thinking through how what would be helpful for the council to be updated on related to data, related on to what's currently happening with trans and non-binary communities and our public health efforts related to HIV. And so in hindsight, thinking back kind of like my experience and kind of, you know, my current role at Gender Health SF, one of the things that kind of really continued to resonate, at least for me, is it's not just about the access anymore, where many community folks and advocates and also planning council members really advocated for access to gender-affirming quality and gender-affirming care. But I think more recently, the thing that I think about too now is, not just access, but the actual quality care that is provided or that trans and non-binary people have access to. What does good care look like? What does inclusive care look like? How does that affect the way in which trans folks engage in the different programs that are offered throughout the whole city? As I was thinking about one of the things that's really, is it okay if I share this slide? So when I was thinking about doing a cultural humility piece, that's a whole full day training. I recognize that we only have a limited amount of time. One of the things that I was thinking, let me get something completely different. Okay. So one of the things that I was thinking about is maybe just do kind of a basic 101. I also just kind of maybe want to get from you all to see if that's really clearly necessary. I don't want to make the assumption that everyone's knowledgeable or aware of kind of the trans 101 basics, such as terms and terminologies, and just like really important cultural humility frameworks. And so I think that was one of the things that I was gonna try to cover in a short period of time and really essentially focus on terms and terminologies. And so what I thought about or planned on actually is kind of really framing it in that context for the council members. But really too, I think one of the things that to get us started into this notion of talking about the 101, one of the things that are currently in the current narratives and discussions around transgender rights and transgender visibility is just acts like just kind of like the current policies and speak to the protections of anti-transgender bills or legislations that are currently in place. So one of the things that I kind of really want to hone in on before we get into the 101, it's really important for I think everyone to actually really know, is just kind of the current acts and policies that exist, particularly in San Francisco, with related to current things that are happening, right? When at the federal level with the Equality Act 2021 that was recently passed, to include gender identity to prohibit non-discrimination. I think that's just really important because the current narrative is actually is this ongoing narrative around the erasure of trans folks and trans rights. So I think that's just a really good kind of setting the tone in terms of what actually trans and non-binary people have access to and their current protections. There's also some specific San Francisco policies that I can get into that really, provides non-discrimination policies around gender identity. The Human Rights Commission also has a current policy that really reinforces this notion that you don't necessarily have to show proof of identity that you're trans to be able to navigate the world. Because I think, again, that kind of really permeates into our current conversation. And so it does really just set this tone for how we think about supporting and creating inclusive spaces for trans folks to navigate their everyday lives. Any questions on that first? Our thoughts? Should I just go on? All right. And then, you know, what I was thinking is I think it might be helpful to do a basic trans 101. And what I was thinking, because there are like kind of nuanced slides around gender identity, terms and concepts, as you kind of can see here, around the use of pronouns and why it's important to use pronouns. And, you know, mind again, if the council members feel like it might not be, if an emphasis on this content might not be mostly needed, please definitely let me know. But I thought that this is a really good way to kind of set the tone for where in which we think about getting comfortable and, you know, kind of really setting that foundation around these basic concepts. One of the things that I was thinking about, because these can actually go a little bit more in detail around sex assigned at birth, gender identity and gender expression, the word transgender in general, and kind of the different identities that fall underneath that. I was wondering if it is possible, there is a beautiful online training that the UCSF Center of Excellence created called Trans 101, Transgender People in Everyday Life and Work. And this is a really good online training. I wanna give props to, because I also helped kind of create this training. But I was thinking we can invite folks to take or review that training before the actual council meeting, because this has a little bit more detail around the cultural humility piece that I don't necessarily will be able to cover in that short period of time. And what I was hoping is that if we do encourage folks to review this training, and I can open it up to you, I can open it up and show you all the actual content. Do you all see the link to the website? Or no? Yeah, okay. So it's just an online training, really dives a little more deeper into the cultural humility 101 concepts. You know, who are trans folks, words matter. Again, some very similar things that I'm gonna be covering in kind of just my basic overview. And, you know, I think there's other more nuanced information here that's just really helpful around kind of microaggressions and kind of thinking about workplace policies and creating like inclusive spaces for trans folks to access services, but also to, you know, to work in. And so I would definitely recommend, if there's a possibility, to encourage council members to take this online course first as a kind of a primer. I think that might be helpful and can, you know, my thinking is that we can actually kind of maybe get into the questions that may have come up as folks have gone through this online training. Let me close this a little bit.
If I could just jump in and say that's absolutely fine for us to send out that with our notice. So if you can email that, what's right there on the screen, I guess, to me. I actually tried clicking on it and then I realized, oh, this is a presentation. I can't do that from here. So just email that to me and we'll include that in the meeting notice and encourage people to take it. As Jack mentioned in chat, we'll see if people do, but I think that's a great idea. Thank you.
Okay, fantastic. All right, so I'll definitely send that to you, Mark. And then it just goes more, I mean, pretty much what I'm gonna just cover, what I'm hoping to cover is just reinforcement of the content that people may have taken. And if they didn't take it, it's, you know, I was gonna spend a little bit of time just kind of going through these concepts are just really important for just foundational information. So I went over this, these are the terms and terminologies and how is that different from sexual orientation? And, you know, kind of social constructions of sex and gender are really important to just, again, set a primer for, you know, general education on gender identity and sexual orientation. And then it gets into this whole idea of intersectional identity, because we all know that we're not just talking about a trans person, but we're talking about trans folks who navigate many different identities related to their being and the humanness and how that all kind of intersects so much in terms of how we think about particularly creating programming prevention efforts that are targeted for our at-most risk populations. Normally I would go into the data here, but I think this is the part where Erin or, you know, or may actually kind of come in at this point to talk about current knowledge and data around specific research that her team has been doing that can help us get a better picture of the current social determinants of health and particularly HIV data that might be helpful for the council member. So just consider, I don't know if this might be a good point, Erin, but just note that that is something that I was thinking, and maybe you and I can follow up and see what the flow might look like for the council. The other thing too that I was thinking about, Mark, that might be helpful is just now that so much of how we're thinking about you know, supporting trans folks, it's just kind of like thinking through what does really good clinical practice and good care look like, that big question that many of us have really been advocating for. And one of the things that I was hoping maybe I can also cover because of our work at Gender Health SF, and, you know, mind you, I'm gonna take a step back a little bit. Gender Health SF was born out of community, from community advocates who really at the time in, I think 2010, maybe 2009, in correlation with the Planning Council, we're advocating to see that, to advocate for a program that really responded to what are the current priorities and needs of trans and non-binary folks. And at the time it was surgery access and really good access to really good care for trans folks. One of the things that we at Gender Health SF has been thinking about is kind of this whole concept of what does really good care look like, and how do we land in this area of whole person care to define it as a way to collaborate with various providers, institutions that are gonna, you know, address not just that actual, not just for example, address HIV, but other things that are related to a trans person's life. And so I was hoping that I could go over a little bit of like what does whole person care look like and some of the clinical best practices that might be helpful in creating, again, inclusive, inclusive spaces and clinical practices that are gender affirming and that could help you know, engagement in care and attention in care and, you know, this whole concept of a patient's care team working together to address their needs. So that's that. The other thing that I was gonna offer, I don't know, it might be useful and definitely open to any thoughts or feedback. It's just specifically around our work at Gender Health SF. I'd like to think that Gender Health SF was born out of the work of the Planning Council and many community advocates. And, you know, there's a fun video that I didn't want to be too talky-talky, but there's a fun video I thought that might be helpful to kind of really speak to the work of our work at Gender Health SF, and particularly this notion of serving our public health populations, right? So it's really, is a program that was born out of community advocacy, but really that is peer driven and a model that really supports trans folks to thrive, but also addresses other things that are experienced by trans folks, such as gender dysphoria. And I can share that video. I don't know if that, you know, I'd like to hear other folks' ideas and thoughts around sharing that video. I can maybe show you a 10-second clip of it to kind of give you an idea. Let me see if I can do this. 1 second. So I'm gonna have to do the sound. Oops, sorry. Do it again. All right, I think this might be it. So.
Gender Health SF is your partner in accessing quality, gender-affirming healthcare. We're peer-led, we value compassion and community investment, and provide care regardless of immigration status or income. We understand that navigating gender-affirming health services is challenging, so we help you at every step to make sure accessing surgery is as easy as possible, including surgery-related education, help selecting and working with your covered surgeon.
So I'm going to stop there, but any thoughts or feedback around, you know, if this video might be helpful for folks to get in, to understand our work at Gender Health SF. And then last but not least, I was going to show some data around client demographics at Gender Health SF. I don't know if that might be useful. Our evaluation, this is a little bit outdated because I think we've last generated this back in 2019. So I was going to have our lead evaluator help update this if that was something that we would be interested in hearing, if the council members are interested in hearing about. But really, I think a really big piece around kind of why it's important to show our data is because I think it really speaks to our target population, our most marginalized trans and non-binary folks, are publicly insured and uninsured trans folks, and many of whom are living with HIV or at great risk for HIV, it would be great if for feedback if folks think that that might be relevant, or if council members are interested in that data. So that's that. And I also have a growing list of other resources that may be helpful particularly around HIV prevention, such as the HIV testing toolkit. There's a toolkit really that speaks to prevention services and programs, particularly targeting transgender women of color. There's a couple of different lists that I'm also working on, but wanted to see from folks if that might also useful. So that's that. Questions or thoughts?
If I can jump in for a moment, I should have made clear that the presentation that you all just saw is actually two parts that will be the first and third part, so that it's a bit more dynamic. So the trans/cultural humility piece will come first, of course, as the very important framing. Aaron will come in with more HIV prevention and care data, and then Jenna will come back in with the information that that is beyond HIV prevention and care, because it's all connected. And so with that said, my only feedback is that the video, yes, I think things like videos are really important to really keep people in a more dynamic mode rather than just getting a passive download of info.
Absolutely.
Jenna, I'm very excited for your presentation. Hey, I'm just wondering how long it is in relationship to the amount of time that's in the agenda.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we have an hour that was slated for both Aaron and I. I know I have a lot of slides, but I was also kind of gonna kind of chop it up a little bit more. I haven't had time to do that and just kind of, you know, take some really critical pieces. But I'm trying to contain what I'm hoping to cover in just about 20 minutes, the first section, and then turn it over to Aaron for 30 minutes, maybe 10 minutes to do the last piece.
I should also be clear that the hour does not include Q&A, so that'll be on top of that. Full hour. There actually might be a break in between. We might do a break, I'd say, between Aaron and then Jenna's second piece as well. Depends, or it might be somewhere else, so that the hour doesn't feel like purely an hour.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, an hour seems good for that. Usually our presentations are a little shorter, and so I was looking at the slides being like, oh shit, this is really long. But I think everything that you're including is really good. I think the temptation might be to remove the beginning, like what is transgender and what is a gender pronoun? Because I think that maybe you know, at one time or another, I think probably most people on the council have gotten some kind of training about that, but I would leave it. I think if we can, just to make sure we're, you know, we're all on the same page, I guess.
Yeah.
All right, Jenner, should I dip in at this point?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, awesome. I'll share my screen. I've been in an all-day meeting since 5, so if I start talking gibberish, you know why. Okay. All right, can y'all see the slide set?
Yep.
Okay, cool. Okay, So I'll make sure that this is down to a half hour. So I might cut some of the background a bit, but I wanna just let the council know who I am. I work at the health department. This is a snippet of our team. Our research unit's called the Trans Research Unit for Equity. But I wear a lot of hats. I'm also the board president of TAJA Coalition, which is the Coalition to End Violence and the Genocide of Trans Women of Color. And I'm also an faculty at an Epi and Biostats at UCSF. So I just want to put that out there as like a potential resource from a variety of angles in any way that can support the work of the council. And I've come from this, having done this for a long time when I was a little baby, many, many years, moons ago in Los Angeles at the first adolescent health clinic for, Jenna and I like switched spots now, and I was doing gender affirming care stuff back in the day and was really thankful to stand on the shoulders of the women there that taught me all the things I know now that, and all the lessons learned that I still hold with me closely, and then got to meet all of these amazing advocates and people in services and research. Obviously, this is just a small smattering of pictures, but some of the people closest to me in the world of HA research and trans communities. So I just want to acknowledge that I stand on the shoulders of the knowledge and the groundwork that all of these amazing people and more have laid to do this work. Including, of course, Ms. Billy, who was in this amazing article and I know is a council member. So I just wanted to uplift her and show her. She was did a legacy seminar for some scholars of us recently, and I was just inspired once more. So just to give a quick run, I'm going to do a whole smattering of data. And like I said, I'll try to pare down to keep it hyperlocal, get rid of some of the national stuff. But Jenna actually is the beginning of this timeline here is when I started working with Jenna, who ran our kind of reboot of behavioral surveillance of trans communities in 2010. And from then, that data set has really spawned a ton of studies and intervention research that I'll talk about some of the findings here. Okay, so I might just dip out some of this national stuff, unless folks are really interested in like the state of the science nationally and where we are. I can try to keep a couple here, but of note, we had the very first HIV behavioral surveillance study of trans women across the USA funded by CDC that we've all been lobbying for like 30 years to get. So for the first time we did this at the end of 2019, early 2020. And this was the prevalence estimate, which is very different from what we see in the case surveillance, but in communities around the 7 sites in the US, 42% of trans women tested positive for HIV. So the highest population specific prevalence of, you know, almost any key population in the US. And where we are situated in that, you know, our prevalence is at around 40%, which has been consistent for the last few decades. And that's actually a lower prevalence than other places. So that 41 was a mean, and we have it as high as almost 60% of trans women in Atlanta tested positive for HIV. So an extraordinarily highly impacted community by HIV. And then in our case surveillance data, you know, about 1.3% of people receiving HIV care in the US are trans women, which is a much higher proportion than what we estimate trans people make up of the US population. So some disproportionate stuff there. And one of the findings folks had with the medical monitoring project using case surveillance data was that in addition to having less viral suppression, durable viral suppression, and less ART dose adherence, there were also higher unmet needs for basic needs like food and housing. So that will be kind of a theme in our data as well. There's less surveillance data with trans men and non-binary people. This is kind of a rundown some studies done in Canada, the US, and Spain recently, and these are prevalence estimates within the studies ranging from anything from 0.6% to 5.3% in studies of non-binary folks in Canada. So a lot less known there. And so I just want to provide that kind of caveat that we have a lot less data. So it'll be really heavily focused on trans women of color specifically. So quick rundown, this is our case surveillance data. Really cool thing that we do in San Francisco that nobody else does around the nation is captures trans women and trans men in our surveillance data. So we actually can see for last time they ran this in 2019 was the first time trans men were captured. And often trans men were in our case surveillance data, but because the number was low, we didn't want it to be identifying of people, so they weren't reported. So that was in honor of people's privacy. But now the percentage is substantial enough that trans men are now represented in our case surveillance data. So as you can see, trans folks make up a much bigger proportion of our case surveillance data than they do of people in the city. So really disproportionately impacted in those data. And then we go out to the community. So the folks who may not also be engaged in the care system, we've seen this like steady trend. This is not a perfect data set, but as we see the trend around HIV prevalence has been the same for a very long time. This last data set was one of our smallest ones, which may be why we got that 41% that we kind of captured all the folks living with HIV early, and then the study kind of ended. But altogether, you know, we haven't seen real reductions in the prevalence. And we had our first chance to actually ask, you know, we have this interesting question in San Francisco about where trans women are acquiring HIV. And, you know, we try to back into it with molecular epi and all of this fancy backend kind of data. And what we tend to not do is just ask people. So we were really fortunate this last time we collected data with trans women, we asked them about their HIV story, and they were really forthcoming and shared with us. And this is a whole other story about, you know, science, but it was really cool just to see, you know, the era in which people acquired HIV. There were people in our study 5 that were before 1986, so long-term survivors, all the way to fairly recent, even in 2010 to 2016, 17 participants had acquired HIV, which is incredible because there was PrEP scale-up, and we were in the era of ART, and then also some really recent acquisitions as well. So we see that trans women continue to acquire HIV. And then we have some data on where they were tested. So a lot of people in primary care, which I might attribute to our amazing gender-affirming care system in San Francisco. So people are getting their care and they're getting tested, which I think is really a testament to the whole person care that's offered in our public health system. The most important thing we found about this, which we thought was really interesting, that was, you know, what percentage of trans women acquired HIV through sexual assault. Almost 14% of them said they acquired HIV through sexual assault, which was extraordinary. And then, you know, but the vast majority, almost half of them said that they acquired HIV from their cis man partner as a trans woman. And this is intuitive to us. This is a no-brainer to all of us in San Francisco, but in this, you know, in the world of science, a lot of, we know that trans women often get aggregated with MSM in intervention studies and research studies. It's a huge problem because they never represented adequately enough to say anything about trans women when they are included. And then the interventions aren't really tailored to them. So this is a drum we've all been beating for years and years and years about we need trans specific studies and interventions for trans and non-binary folks. And then we were really fortunate to get funding to do a global incident study. It was the first dedicated incident study that wasn't embedded in other work. And we found an HIV incidence of 1.3 per 100 person years among trans women overall. And that was a cohort of 415 trans women we followed. And those data we just looked at published very recently last year. So that's not good, but it's not terrible. But when we look a little bit more closely, we see that those who are younger had a higher incidence, more than twice the as high incidence, which is really a problem. So we see a whole new generation of young trans women being more highly impacted by HIV. We also saw that Latina, Latinx trans women were significantly more impacted by new cases of HIV. And this is something, you know, even we talk in community, a lot of people don't know how many Latinx, Latina trans women are being impacted. So we have a lot of work to do around age disparities and racial ethnic disparities if we're going to do targeted prevention and care work. And then also this association with incarceration, that those who had ever been incarcerated were 2.3, had a 2.3 per 100 person year incidence rate. So again, elevated incidence rate among those who were incarcerated. So then we need to ask, okay, how are we doing about getting people into care? And this is, these bars are, you know, linkage to care is the pink, and then the plaid is the currently on ART, and then the last purple bar is how many trans women indicated that they were virally suppressed. So this is up to 2016, and this is the most recent data, which is, we're still really struggling. So in our case surveillance data, trans women have something like a well into the 80% are virally suppressed, but we always have this bias of looking at case surveillance data. Those are the people in our health system. So these this study is from trans women in the community. So they are not necessarily in our health system. And we see that it's a much lower undetectable rate than we see in the case surveillance data. So we need to do, seems like we've tested everybody and tested them a million times over, but we still need to do a better job at getting people tested and engaged in care. Let's see, what did I skip? Let's keep going forward. We did do a study in 2015. We collaborated with a community advisory board and rolled out, we were able to get NIH funding to do like the first surveillance study of trans men. This 94.3% are the number of folks that participated in the study. It was more than 150, close to 200 trans men participated. Almost all agreed to be tested, but not everybody did, which is about 6% that did not agree to be HIV tested. Among those who were tested, none of them tested positive. So that was a good thing, but we did still see a significant amount of sexually transmitted infection. So we know that we have some room to grow there as far as serving the community for STI testing, and also just making sure everybody gets tested. So we may have missed people with that 6% that didn't get tested. So, when we think about what do we need to be doing here, I think one of the biggest things is that we need to have an intersectionality lens when we're working on HIV prevention and care for trans communities. And we need, you know, one thing that continues to happen is that trans women are not at the forefront of rollout of new modalities of biomedical prevention. Obviously, biomedical is not going to be enough, but we need to make sure that trans women and trans people are included when those new interventions are out. And they haven't been. So PrEP, and I'll show some data on that about what a difficult time we had with PrEP rollout for a lot of reasons, partly because trans women were not included in those rollout efforts. And we need to test all of our modalities specifically with trans folks, not with trans folks embedded with other communities. We need to embed all of our interventions in the lived experience of trans women, have trans women be at the helm of these interventions and studies. And we do need to tackle systemic racism as heady and difficult as that is. Until we do, we're not really going to be able to move the needle. So one of our biggest issues we're always fighting, this is a picture of a cluster from our molecular epi, you know, in addition to trans women saying they acquired HIV as trans women, that's one piece of data. We also have this molecular data, and I don't know how familiar folks are with our surveillance data. I'm not super familiar with it, but some folks, my boss, Dr. Willie McFarland and Hong Ha Chung at UCSF, we got together to look at our surveillance data. And one thing we found that was really interesting when we looked at the molecular epi was that we want to see, where are trans women falling in clusters? Are they in clusters with people who inject drugs? Are they in clusters with other MSM? Let's test some of our hypotheses. And what we found out was that if there's a trans woman in a cluster and there is a male sex partner, that person is categorized as MSM. And that may not be relevant to their, you know, this is the problem of putting like a behavioral category on a molecular cluster. So, you know, what we did was we kind of reconfigured a bunch of these clusters to look at, hey, could this be the case that these clusters are not accurate? And when we look at them a little bit more closely, we find that trans women actually aren't in clusters with MSM in our molecular clusters. So we really need to look at our data closer because we don't really have a grasp of the epidemic. First, we're creating a bunch of MSM that aren't MSM on one hand. On the other hand, we're losing trans women and not understanding where they're acquiring HIV and how to best serve their prevention and care needs. So that is the drum we're beating all the time. The other thing we're working on is also just PrEP rollout. So we we just completed a study, a prep demonstration project study that Jenna helped us get funded and guide the work of getting prep out to trans folks in the Bay Area broadly. We coordinated with three clinics in San Francisco and one in Fremont, the Transvision Clinic. And these data show kind of really low prep use. If you look at like the pink bars there, the pink columns, you'll see that in 2016, 2017, only 25.86% of PrEP eligible trans women had ever used PrEP. So that was 5 years after rollout began. And San Francisco, as you all know, was one of the testing grounds for PrEP rollout. So that's extraordinarily low and a problem and something that we know that we need to work on. I can go over this with the group, but these are all things we know, which is, you know, all of our HIV work needs to be intersectional, and we need to kind of look at these people as whole people, and the drivers that are working at every level is what we're coming to, especially as we get closer to the getting to new, you know, zero new infections and to closing that gap with viral suppression. I think what we're seeing is we will have to do a complete pivot. The tools and prevention that we did before are not going to work for that remaining 10% of people. We're going to have to really wrap our arms around them and make sure all of their needs are met if we're going to see reductions in new cases. And just to kind of make that case, you know, we saw that we ran a project for trans women of color living with HIV funded by HRSA as a SPINS project, and it was actually using critical race theory as our theoretical model. So that's bananas in this political environment. But the whole idea was that we actually offered, in addition to gender affirming care services, in addition to the existing HIV care services, we also offered these like engagement workshops and a legal clinic. And it was the most amazing project I've worked on to date, where we actually connected the dots between somebody. I don't know if folks read the East Bay Law Center report a few years ago about how like traffic fines turned into warrants that turned into arrests that turned into incarceration that turned into massive amounts of debt on families. Well, we are seeing that in the East Bay among a lot of trans women that had traffic tickets and DUIs that were unresolved because they couldn't pay the legal fee to resolve them, which then resulted in them having this cascade of structural issues that really prevented them from going to their care appointments. So then they couldn't go to their care appointment because they're working at night and, you know, at an Amazon warehouse because they can't drive and it takes them 6 hours to get to and from work on a bus and these really difficult circumstances. And in that study, we also found that, you know, so many people were running out of money in the last month, multiple times. So many people were doing sex work to get by. And we found that 15% of trans women over the course of our study were in and out of jail or prison. So these big structural issues are what we're going to have to tackle. And just pervasive, massive discrimination. You know, almost a quarter of trans women in that study had experienced discrimination at shelters, in looking for housing, in job discrimination, trying to get health insurance, you know, for those in the East Bay that didn't have Healthy San Francisco, and even discrimination by their doctors, which then no doubt then resulted in a massive amount of medical mistrust where people didn't necessarily trust that doctors had their best interests in mind. And granted, you know, a third or so of people did, but a third didn't. That's a really big problem. And we know that that leads to healthcare avoidance from discrimination in healthcare and poor physical and mental health outcomes. And I know, Jenna, you can probably speak to this a lot better than I can, that even when we have a gender-affirming care system, people already come to the system with so much trauma in the medical system, being misgendered and dead-named and not given the services they want, that by the time they come here, there's so much that has to be unpacked to establish trust that it becomes a real challenge to engage people in care. We also see another big, heady issue is violence. This is an infographic we put together with that last data set we collected last year, showing that that like middle of the Venn diagram are the trans women that experienced homelessness in the last year. So that we know that people who are experiencing homelessness are experiencing violence at much higher rates and percentages than those who have more stable housing. And we know that housing is one of our main predictors of lack of viral suppression and engagement in coping behaviors. So even though, again, violence, housing, very big, heady, difficult issues, but we're not going to get to zero until we address these issues, especially in trans communities in a city that's supposed to be safe. These were all San Francisco residents. And we know from experience, our participants are on the daily facing community violence, partner violence, violence in community as well. So this is a really big issue we need to tackle that's really directly related to HIV. And then when we look at our participants who were in well-established into care, we know that, when we talk to trans women who are report being virally suppressed or at least engaged and linked to care, a lot of them are not taking their ARTs, don't have a detectable viral load. And then a lot are really facing serious mental health issues, including suicidality. And there's a lot of substance use. So more than 30% of our last study of trans women, of all of the trans women living with HIV, had used meth recently. And then we can't forget COVID. So we did a recent QOL assessment with providers and leaders in the community and trans women living with HIV, finding that COVID had a huge impact. The transition to health telehealth has meant less viral load monitoring. And I'm sure you all saw, probably put together those getting to zero data showing that like 30% fall off on viral suppression. I think trans women are highly impacted by this. Major staff changes. So with the activation, the mental health and substance use service system has been highly impacted, where those who were activated had to give their whole caseload to other people, creating much longer wait lines for services. And that's happening at the same time. Isolation, a lack of transportation and lack of the ability to go outside safely has created increased mental health needs. So I think in the next year, as we peel the layers to see what happened because of COVID, we're going to have to really backfill a lot of gaps. This is a lot of data, but so I'll boil it down. You know, we just completed a study with partners of trans women who we don't want to leave out, who often get left out in our thinking about what are the needs of trans women. We forget that there's this whole other half of their lives that we're ignoring. And what we found out was that the life circumstances of many trans women in the city and their partners are really similar. That where we did find differences were that trans women were more likely to have done sex work lately. And then their partners were more likely to have condomless sex. On the protective side, we saw that trans women were significantly more likely to be PrEP users compared to their partners. So I think we know this anecdotally. We know that trans women compared to other populations have fewer sexual partners and higher engagement in protective behaviors. And this kind of points to that as well. As far as the needs, going back to our STRIPE study with trans guys a few years ago, we, in addition to unmet sexual health needs, we also found a lot of suicidal ideation. So 80% of trans men reported suicidal ideation in their lifetime, and almost half reported a suicide attempt. So that's where we saw a big need in the community, was around mental health services. But protective factors did prevent and help folks cope with that. Social support was the most significant factor that was protective. And then we also did a study just looking at behavior changes for trans men related to testosterone. So almost a third reported having new sexual behaviors as a result of starting testosterone, an increase in sexual activity, an increase in the number of cis men and trans women sexual partners. So I think we also need to be really cognitive and culturally competent in addressing the sexual health needs of trans men, especially as it relates to impacts of testosterone. Okay, feel free to time check me whenever. I don't even know what day it is right now, so just let me know if I'm going on.
We have about 7 more minutes until the meeting is officially over, so I guess this would be your time check.
Okay, I'm gonna do real quick, just let you know, there's all these data and we're doing something about it. So what we're doing is we have a really cool PrEP project that we rolled out. This is part of the campaign for the STAY study in those 4 clinics, which were amazing. It was an amazing opportunity to roll out PrEP in really gender-affirming, trusted care sites. We also established our own clinic for folks who worked at night or couldn't go to clinic during regular business hours or weren't interested in gender-affirming care and hormones. So we opened a clinic at our research site at 25 Van Ness, and almost half of the participants came there in a different segment of the community, which was really cool. And if there's any way to keep that going, you know, we're trying to get it funded, but funding is difficult, and we're really working toward increasing options for PrEP access. The good news was we found that this is a comparison in time from 2016 to 2019. So the purples back in the a few years ago, and the blue was post-intervention. So once we did the stay study, we can attribute it partly to just rollout continuing over those years, but we also think because of the stay study, we had a big uptick in the percent who use PrEP. So we went from 14% overall in 2016, 2017 to almost half. And we didn't recruit from our study, we recruited from the community, and far less than half of our participants had been in the stay study, but we think we had a good impact with that. So it was exciting to see that we have PrEP usage comparable to other communities that would use PrEP in the city, which is super exciting. Despite that, we did see that tenofovir levels, so PrEP levels in our DPS were lower for those that had a precarious housing situation, so who had food insecurity, for those who lived in motels, hotels, and boarding houses, and for those who were multiracial, which we don't quite know how to explain that, but I think just speaking to these structural barriers, like if we're going to get to that last 10%, we're going to have to address food, violence, housing, job security, discrimination. Remaining issues are those that I just talked about. And then we're also working on the care side. So Dr. Lynn and I are working with a couple other investigators to work within Tom Waddell to have an intensive mHealth navigation system to help folks, trans women specifically living with HIV, engage in their mental health and substance use services. So helping identify those services and solidify those linkages, because we think that is a really important upstream factor that we have to address, and ideas that will be there for them at a group level to help carry those folks who are still thinking about engagement in those services. We'll also engage them on this interpersonal navigation level, and then we'll also have like social support through those groups so we can destigmatize and educate around services. Big old crazy graph of all the barriers. And then just going back to, we really do need to have this intersectional approach to prevention and care for trans communities. Lastly, I just want to make a plug. We have an amazing NIH-funded training program for trans scholars of color. So we're hoping to train and support for the rest of their life scholars who are interested in doing HIV research with trans communities from trans communities. So we're hoping to build the next group of leaders. I was actually going to see if this meeting is open to the public, if I might be able to invite them. Yeah. Okay. Awesome. That would be very cool for them to be able to come, though they might be sick of hearing me talk. So that's just a plug of what we're doing in the city. And then this is just my favorite last slide, which is when you actually just go ask trans women specifically, what would they change in the Bay? It's all of the factors that we know are that final frontier for us, which is ending stigma and discrimination, promoting acceptance, providing housing. And then these other issues that we've done a pretty good job around, medical access and services are there, but there's a lot more structurally that we need to do. And I think that is it.
That was wonderful. Jack, did you have a question?
Yes, I had one question. I also want to say that was fantastic. I love all your infographics. I thought it was amazing. I really appreciate it. My one question was from on your slide, the first slide where you talked about transmission and like the percentages of sexual partners and different partners and things like that. You had the top percent, I think, was transmission with sex with men, and then it kind of got broken down. And some of the ones that was broken down into, one of them was like sex with someone who uses needles. And then there was another one. And I guess my question is, are the percentages that are for the other kinds of transmission where the partner was male? So like sex with a male partner who uses needles, is that included in the 43% of sex with straight transgender partner or straight cisgender partners? Or are they separated out just so we can see them all? Or are they separated out because they're not included in the same percent? Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally. So they shouldn't be included. All this is with a big caveat that this was an open-ended question. So it was, we had to kind of like qualitatively code it, which was difficult. But the idea was that they were like distinct categories. And, some people said, we don't know. I don't know if it was sex or injection drug use, which is that 7.6%. So, that's like an aggregate. And obviously that might overlap with something else. But there were quite a few people who said that specific phrase. And so we kind of parse them out. And then those, you know, sex with a partner who injected drugs, sometimes they didn't say the sex or gender of their partner, so we don't know, but they just said partner. And so those, that was that other sex, 7.6%. And so, yes, so it's, you know, not the cleanest data, probably lots of overlap with some interpretation because it was kind of qualitative. And we just tried to group it as neatly as we could with what we were working with.
Okay, that's great. Okay.
Jesse has a question.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, yeah, also love it. Love the focus on all the structural stuff, all the lifting up of your trans mentors and community members. I got a little lost at 2 points, like one talking about incidence rates with like person years. And so maybe just like, maybe just, I mean, I think I got the point that like the incidence is higher among these groups. So, I mean, maybe I didn't get lost, but just the language, like maybe using a little more lay friendly language. And then the other piece was around like the, what was it? The molecular clusters. And again, just, I mean, I think the point you're making is, you know, is that grouping trans women with MSM, you know, we lose data and nuance and stuff, but just I got a little lost there for a while.
Those are I get lost even thinking about them, so you know, if that's like too difficult, I mean, it's like a whole dissertation. I could spend a whole day even trying to think about how to explain that. So if that's just messy and unnecessary, I can also take that out. I don't want to get people derailed or anything like that, so maybe I'll just ixnay that one and make the main point. And then person years, I'll just have like a point of comparison. I think that's the best way. Explaining person years doesn't make any sense. It's like a weird epi thing. Maybe as like a point of comparison, I can and can put that there because that's the only way I make meaning of it.
Mark, you have any other questions? No? All right.
A great presentation for sure. I am worried, of course, about the number of slide. So I do like the David's suggestion that to maybe embed some Q&A instead of what we usually do at the very end, but maybe actually after each piece so that it actually happens three times after the first piece, after Aaron's piece, and after Jenna's piece. Does that sound good to you both?
Yeah.
So try to hold any questions, and I'm sure the co-chair will also help with that, but try to hold any in the moment questions for the end of your particular part.
And thank you both very much.
Yes, thank you.
So if there's no other questions, then the next meeting will be August 10th, I believe. Same time. So Jenna, thank everybody. If you
could, just send those presentations to me, or I'm not sure if I CC'd Melina, so okay. I guess just sending it to me in advance of the meeting. We'll send that out with the meeting notice because council members do like to have presentations in advance, but you have up until like the Friday or the Thursday before that meeting. So hopefully that's enough time. And also Jenna, like I mentioned, if you send me that link, we'll include it. Sorry, Chuck.
All right. No, that's fine. So with that, we'll end the meeting and everybody
Chuck,
have a great
day.
Can I ask
a quick question?
Yeah, go ahead, Jesse.
This is unrelated to the presentation and stuff. So
sure, I mean, go ahead.
Folks don't have to stick around. Mark, I'm curious about getting an update from DPH about like the status of the closing of the SAP hotels and like the impact that it's having on our clients and community members. I could just ask that.
Follow up with me on an email.
Sure.
So that maybe we can include it in an agenda item for steering. I don't know if you are able to come to a steering committee meeting. It has been moved to the next Thursday, but I haven't even developed that agenda yet because it has been moved. And I think that's a pretty appropriate question.
I do too.
Right. So I asked Bill Bloom that yesterday, and there's a lot that is sort of like still being vetted. And so he's going to take some time to actually develop a response because there's shelter in place and there's also what's happening with the residential care facilities. And so it's a lot. And so I asked him, hey, can you actually provide some communication on that? Because it's a lot of instability for community members and also some of our council members. So yeah, he's going to be coming back with some more clear sort of like explanation of what's going on with that.
Yeah, cool. If you could just send that though, Aaron, not Aaron, so sorry, Jesse, what's wrong with me? That would help embed it in my mind so that I make sure that it's a part of the agenda.
Okay, I can do that. And the other thing is I'm also curious about like the some of these like police alternative, like crisis response stuff that's going on at the city. And again, I feel like that is also impacting our folks, and just would love to like hear more about that or have like a presentation. I mean, so that could be
like a presentation idea. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Huh. Can you bring that up at our next Council Affairs Committee meeting? And I'll start looking into that myself, but I think that's a good discussion topic.
This meeting next time, you mean?
Yes. I mean, I'll start talking about it or thinking about who I'd connect with before that, but
you're getting beamed up.
Where I am right now. I think that's a good discussion topic here for what we want to actually receive information wise. Cool. But I can start looking at it myself. But yeah, I think
I'll email you about both things.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah.
Okay. Outside that, we'll see everybody, most of you at steering and everybody else at the meeting end of the month. All right.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.